Welcome back, our fellow patriots, to the Patriot Lessons American History and Civics podcast. I'm Judge Michael Warren, and in this episode, we continue our review of Article 1 of the Constitution. We have completed our examination of Sections 1 through 6 of Article 1. In this episode, we will review the first sentence of Section 7 of Article 1, which requires that any legislation for raising revenue must originate in the House of Representatives, but can be amended by the Senate. When I say we, I'm joined by Mike Gerard and bombastic Brent Bassett and spectacular Sheila Guerin and enchanting Aaron Messino. Thank you for all your support. And don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. When we return, bombastic Brent Bassett will get us started.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
As we have previously discussed, the first article of the Constitution establishes the Congress. The first 6 sections define the structure of the Congress, congressional elections, the qualifications for serving as a member of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and certain protections provided to representatives and senators. Section 7 finally starts to address what the Congress actually does. The first sentence of Section 7 provides an exclusive authority over raising revenue to the House of Representatives.
All bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, but the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills.
This provision in modern parlance is often referred to as the Origination Clause. The Origination Clause basically provides that any plans to raise revenue, mostly taxes, must be proposed by the House of Representatives first. The Senate, however, can offer amendments to such proposals. The bills that raise revenue were often called money bills during the time of the founding, so we will hear reference to money bills quite often in this episode. But it is just a bill to raise money through taxes or otherwise. To us, this may seem as an obscure, unimportant allocation of power. It does seem a bit odd and not particularly important, and it was not at the top of the mind with the Constitutional Convention, at least at the beginning of the proceedings, but that changed relatively quickly. As we have discussed earlier, the hard work of the Constitutional Convention was really kicked off on May 29th when Virginia Governor Edmund Randolph introduced a series of resolutions, often called the Virginia Plan, outlining a proposed structure of government that would throw out the Articles of Confederation and replace them with an entirely new constitution. On what would become Flag Day, June 14th, the Virginia Plan was countered by New Jersey delegate William Patterson with his own set of resolutions, often referred to as the New Jersey Plan. On June 18th, New York delegate Alexander Hamilton also laid out his own plan, which was ignored by everyone else. Nothing in the Randolph, Patterson, or Hamilton plans had any provision dealing with money bills. However, on June 13th, Massachusetts delegate Elbridge Gerry moved to prohibit the Senate from originating money bills. He argued that the House of Representatives
was more immediately the representatives of the people, and it was a maxim that the people ought to hold the purse strings. If the Senate should be allowed to originate such bills, they would repeat the experiment till chance should furnish a set of representatives in the other branch who would fall into their snares.
In other words, Gerry was arguing that because the House was going to be elected by the people directly, and the Senate was not going to be so elected, that the people deserved to have the House control how the people's money would be raised. After all, one of the most important of the 27 grievances in the Declaration of Independence was taxation without representation. The Sugar Act, the Stamp Act, and so many other attempts of King and Parliament to drain revenue from the colonies without the consent of the colonists was one of the main reasons for the American Revolution. It was vital, therefore, that the Constitution ensure that the people's direct representatives originate taxes, As Gary saw it, unless they were prevented from doing so, the Senate would repeatedly attempt to circumvent the will of the people until they caught the House of Representatives in their snares. But this was hardly a universally accepted position. South Carolina's Pierce Butler would rise to oppose the position. Butler was born in Ireland to a noble family and joined the British Royal Army as a young man. He fought in the French and Indian War, including in Canada, and returned to Ireland in 1762. Soon, he was back in North America in Nova Scotia and then transferred to Boston to clamp down on colonial resistance to British oppression. In fact, a detachment of his 29th Regiment of Foot were involved in the Boston Massacre in 1770. In 1771, he married a local South Carolina girl, whose father happened to be a wealthy planter and colonial leader. He was ordered to return to England in 1773, but he quit instead, giving up his position as a major, and he sold his commission, using the proceeds to purchase a plantation. When fighting broke out in 1775, he supported the Patriots. His father-in-law became the president of the Continental Congress, and his brother-in-law signed the Declaration of Independence. In 1776, Pierce was elected to the South Carolina legislature, where he served until 1789. The American Revolution all but ruined him financially, but over time, he bounced back to become one of the wealthiest men in America. He would eventually serve in the U.S. Senate for 3 terms. Butler saw no reason to reserve money bills for the House of Representatives. "We were always following the British Constitution when the reason of it did not apply. There was no analogy between the House of Lords and the body proposed to be established. If the Senate should be degraded by any such discriminations, the best men would be apt to decline serving in it in favor of the other branch, and it will lead the latter into the practice of tacking other clauses to money bills." Butler wanted both the Senate and House to be able to propose money bills. This would ensure that men of talent would run for both houses, and it would stop the House from playing shenanigans with its authority. If money bills couldn't be amended by the Senate, then the House would add all kinds of non-revenue measures to the money bills to protect them from being amended. It would be like adding road construction, border control measures, military assistance to an ally, and the naming of a post office to a tax measure. Hard to believe that the legislators would play legislative tricks back then. Obviously, that would not happen today. Ugh, don't blame me. Judge Warren writes the scripts. In any event, Virginia's James Madison weighed in on Butler's side. First, he played dumb, or extremely intelligent, and argued that no one knew why the House of Commons had this privilege of originating money bills, and whatever reason it might be, could not possibly apply here. Second, the Senate would be representing the people too, and they would be the more able leaders, so there was no reason to handcuff the Senate. The commentators on the British Constitution had not yet agreed on the reason of the restriction on the House of Lords in money bills. I am certain there could be no similar reason in the case before us. The Senate would be the representatives of the people as well as the first branch. If they should have any dangerous influence over it, they would easily prevail on some member of the latter to originate the bill they wished to be passed. As the Senate would be generally a more capable set of men, it would be wrong to disable them from any preparation of the business, especially of which was most important and, in our republics, worse prepared than any other. Massachusetts delegate Rufus King agreed with Butler and Madison. Delaware's George Reed, on the other hand, had a finessed position. He thought the House of Representatives should be the only chamber to originate money bills, but he thought the Senate should have the right to amend them. South Carolina's Charles Coatsworth Pinckney thought the convention was getting ahead of itself. They had not yet decided how the Senate was going to work. Some were arguing for it to be based on population. Some even argued by popular election. Others thought that each state should have the same number of senators and represent the states. How this decision was made should determine how money bills would be treated. Connecticut delegate Roger Sherman thought this debate was pretty much ado about nothing. It was obvious that the Senate should be allowed to legislate money bills.
As both branches must concur, there can be no danger whichever way the Senate may be formed. We established two branches in order to get more wisdom, which is particularly needed in the finance business. The Senate bear their share of the taxes and are also the representatives of the people. What a man does by another, he does by himself, is a maxim. In Connecticut, both branches can originate in all cases, and it has been found safe and convenient. Whatever may have been the reason of the rule as to the House of Lords, it is clear that no good arises from it now even there.
Pinckney took to the floor to reinforce Sherman's point from another perspective. While Sherman explained that allowing both the Senate and the House had gone along swimmingly well in his state, Pinckney's experience was entirely different. In South Carolina, having the power reserved to the House had caused great mischief. This distinction prevails in South Carolina and has been a source of pernicious disputes between the two branches. The Constitution is now evaded by informal schedules of amendments handed down from the Senate to the other house. In other words, the constitutional provision in South Carolina resulted in bitter infighting between the branches, as well as awkward and obviously unnecessary logistical hurdles to passing legislation. The question was called. Gary's proposal to have money bills only originate in the House of Representatives was defeated 7-3. But, as Mike Girard is going to tell you, that was just the beginning of the debate.
That's right, bombastic Brent Bassett. It wouldn't be a constitutional convention debate unless it took many twists and turns. On July 2, 1787, when the Constitutional Convention appeared to be at a deadlock over how votes would be allocated in the Senate, South Carolina delegate Charles Pinckney, not Charles Coatsworth Pinckney, remember there were two of these guys, moved that a committee attempt to draft a compromise. James Madison and James Wilson vehemently objected, but the convention approved the motion and appointed a committee composed of one delegate from each state. The compromise committee consisted of Elbridge Gerry, Oliver Ellsworth, Robert Yates, William Patterson, Benjamin Franklin, Gunning Bedford, Luther Martin, George Mason, William Davey, John Rutledge, and Abraham Baldwin. Massachusetts delegate Gerry was the chair. In the committee, Franklin made a motion that became the basis of the report of the committee that was released on July 5th. The committee was brokering the Grand Compromise, in which the Congress would have two chambers, a House of Representatives, in which representation was rooted in population, and a Senate, in which each state would be represented equally. As an essential part of this proposed Grand Compromise, the committee specifically recommended that bills addressing government revenue, spending, and the setting of compensation of government officials only be originated by the House of Representatives. This proposal was made because the House would be elected directly by the people, and the committee reasoned that those particular matters should be proposed only by such representatives. It was assumed that the Senate would be elected indirectly by the state legislatures or otherwise. The report read as follows.
1. That in the first branch of the legislature, each of the states now in the Union shall be allowed one member for each 40,000 inhabitants of the description reported in the 7th resolution of the Committee of the Whole House. That each state not containing that number shall be allowed one member. That all bills for raising or appropriating money and for the fixing of salaries of the officers of the government of the United States shall originate in the first branch of the legislature, and shall not be altered or amended by the second branch, and that no money shall be drawn from the public treasury but in pursuance of appropriations to be originated in the first branch. 2. That in the second branch, each state shall have an equal vote.
Madison explained how the money bill provision was an essential and indispensable part of this proposed Grand Compromise.
There were 5 states which had opposed the equality of votes in the Senate, namely
Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, as a compensation for the sacrifice extorted from them on this head, the exclusive origination of money bills in the other house had been tendered.
Now we can perceive how this seemingly obscure reservation of power was actually vitally important at the Constitutional Convention. Still, just because it was a compromise didn't mean it was controversial. In fact, quite the opposite. The July 5th report triggered a heated debate on many fronts, much of which we have discussed in prior episodes about how the House of Representatives and Senate were composed. That heated debate inevitably swept in the origination clause. In fact, the next day, July 6th, the heated debate turned directly to the origination clause. Virginia's Governor Morris started the discussion. He explained that the answer should not turn on the composition of the Senate. However, the Senate was composed, it should be allowed to propose bills, giving an opportunity for the people to compare the merits of competing proposals between the two houses. Pennsylvania's James Wilson thought neither house should have the exclusive power to originate money bills, but if one were to have one, it ought to be the Senate because they would be more likely to deliberately and carefully consider such matters. This was so because its members would be more experienced and it was a smaller chamber. Having examined the British and American models, Wilson saw no advantage for reserving origination to either chamber. But he would like to hear if others could explain why the proposal was advantageous. North Carolina's Hugh Williamson concurred with Wilson. If one branch were to have this privilege, it ought to be the Senate, because they would be under greater scrutiny when they deliberated. With just a few senators debating money bills, their votes and positions could be more carefully monitored by the people. Virginia's George Mason was a member of the committee that drafted the July 5th report. He couldn't sit by idly anymore. He stood up and vehemently objected to this nonsense of vesting the Senate with this awesome responsibility.
"The consideration which weighed with the committee was that the first branch would be the immediate representatives of the people. The second would not. Should the latter have the power of giving away the people's money, they might soon forget the source of giving away the people's money. They might soon forget the source from whence they received it. We might soon have an aristocracy."
Mason was concerned that because the Senate was not directly accountable to the people, and remember, the Constitutional Convention would agree to have senators elected by the state legislatures, and so he thought the Senate would lose touch with the people, that the Senate would tax the people excessively and spend it on themselves, that they would create an aristocracy like was so prevalent across the world and history. Wow, such a cynical view. That politicians would put their own interests ahead of their constituents? Can you believe that Mason thought that politicians would be self-interested and pass legislation that would benefit themselves and their cronies? Huh, I mean, it's a good thing that that never happens today. But back to the constitutional debate. So Pennsylvania's James Wilson thought this was simply nonsense. The House of Representatives would have to approve whatever the Senate came up with, so it mattered not at all which chamber originated bills for revenue and taxation. "If I had proposed that the second branch should have an independent disposal of public money, the observations of Colonel Mason would have been a satisfactory answer. But nothing could be farther from what I said. My question was, how was the power of the first branch increased or that of the second diminished by giving the proposed privilege of origination of revenue bills to the former? Where is the difference in which branch it begins if both must concur in the end?" Elbridge Gerry added that barring the Senate from this authority deprived the nation of those who would possess more knowledge in light of their longer terms, and it would also signal that the people had no confidence in the Senate in connection with these issues, which would lessen their weight and influence. Governor Morris agreed with Gerry. First, he thought an aristocracy was inevitable. The real issue was how to stop it from doing mischief. Second, the Senate would be more capable than the House in addressing taxes if amendments were not allowed that would simply undermine good policy. As to the alarm sounded of an aristocracy, my creed was that there never was nor ever will be a civilized society without an aristocracy. My endeavor was to keep it as much as possible from doing mischief. The restriction, if it has had any real operation, will deprive us of the services of the second branch in digesting and proposing money bills, of which it will be more capable than the first branch. It will take away the responsibility of the second branch, the great security for good behavior. It will always leave a plea as to an obnoxious money bill that it was disliked, but could not be constitutionally amended, nor safely rejected. Governor Morris raised another key argument. Giving the House a prominent role in money bills would be a source of serious agitation between the two chambers. They might even come to deadlocks, as they had in England. Deadlocks in Britain could be broken loose by the king, but there was no such remedy under the American system of government that they were forging. It will be a dangerous source of disputes between the two houses. We should either take the British Constitution altogether or make one for ourselves. The executive, that is the king in Great Britain, has dissolved the two houses as the only cure for such disputes. Will our executive, the president, be able to apply such a remedy? Every law, directly or indirectly, takes money out of the pockets of the people. Again, what use may be made of such a privilege in case of great emergency? Suppose an enemy at the door, and money be instantly and absolutely necessary for repelling him. May not the popular branch, or the House of Representatives, avail itself of this duress to extort concessions from the Senate destructive of the Constitution itself? This danger can be easily illustrated by the example of the Long Parliament of England, which saw the House of Lords continuously subverted by the lower house. Therefore, I must conclude that this restriction would be either useless or pernicious. As Governor Morris explained, English history showed that deadlocks between the two chambers of the legislature could happen, and they might be deadlocked indefinitely. He also thought the House could leverage emergencies to extract concessions from the Senate, like the House of Commons had done to the House of Lords in England. The elder statesman Benjamin Franklin rose to support the committee's report. He was Pennsylvania's representative on the committee, and after all, he had made the motion to approve the report. He swatted away the dangers and extolled the virtues of the provision. The origination clause would best serve the principle that the people's representatives must approve taxes, and that meant the House of Representatives must originate revenue bills. In fact, this was so important, he'd rather not have a Senate at all if it came to that. This was no idle suggestion. His home state of Pennsylvania had no Senate.
I do not mean to go into a justification of the report, but as has been asked, what would be the use of restraining the Senate from meddling with money bills, I cannot but remark that it was always of importance that the people should know who had disposed of their money and how it has been disposed of. It was a maxim that those who feel can best judge. This end will, I think, be best attained if money affairs are to be confined to the immediate representatives of the people. This end, I think, will be best attained if money affairs are to be confined to the immediate representatives of the people. This is my inducement to concur in the July 5th report. As to the danger or difficulty that might arise from a negative in the Senate where the people would not be proportionally represented, it might easily be got over by declaring that there should be no such negative, or that it will not do by declaring that there shall be no such branch at all.
Franklin was the oldest member of the convention, but he was still very feisty. He would rather abolish the Senate than to give it the power to originate money bills. Maryland's Luther Martin and James Wilson wrapped up the debate on July 6th without changing the tenor of the discussion. On the yet-to-occur anniversary of Bastille Day, that is July 14th, the convention returned to this topic at the request of South Carolina delegate John Rutledge. In fact, he wanted to go over not just that, but whether the state should have an equal vote in the Senate. Remember, this was all part of the July 5th report and had been exhaustively debated, as revealed in prior episodes. You can imagine eyes rolling at this suggestion. Roger Sherman immediately declared, "Let's just approve the entire July 5th report. Otherwise, we'll need to debate the entire report again." Luther Martin concurred. He openly expressed that he was opposed to much of the July 5th report, but agreed to approve it as part of a grand compromise. James Wilson, however, took the bait and began to debate the report again. He was always willing to debate again when his side had previously lost. In connection with the money bills, he opposed reserving the right to originate them in the House only, but thought it was only a minor concern. Elbridge Gerry was willing to re-debate equality in the Senate, but he
does not approve of a reconsideration of the clause relating to money bills. It was of great consequence. It was the cornerstone of the accommodation. If any member of the convention had the exclusive privilege of making propositions, would anyone say that it would give him no advantage over the members? The report was not altogether to my mind, but I would agree to it as it stood rather than throw it out altogether.
The convention was tiring of the circular debate. They couldn't even decide how important this issue was. Some, like Wilson, thought it was nearly irrelevant, and others, like Gerry, thought it was the cornerstone to the Constitution. Perhaps exhausted and exasperated, the convention sent the issue, among 100 others, to a new committee. And as we've learned in prior episodes, that committee produced a report on August 6th, which was really the first full-fledged draft of the Constitution for the delegates to review. Article 4, Section 5 of the August 6th report addressed the issue this way.
All bills for raising or appropriating money and for fixing the salaries of the officers of government shall originate in the House of Representatives and shall not be altered or amended by the Senate. No money shall be drawn from the public treasury, but in pursuance of appropriations that shall originate in the House of Representatives.
So the report basically retired the July 5th report. It eliminated the reference to salaries being exclusively the province of the House of Representatives, and remember, congressional salaries were hotly contested, as we addressed in a prior episode. The August 6th report proposed that any bills that raised or spent money had to originate in the House, and in fact, could not be altered or amended by the Senate. This, of course, did not end the issue. On August 13th, the convention considered the August 6th report in connection with the origination clause. Virginia's Edmund Randolph moved that the clause be altered to read,
"Bills for raising money for the purpose of revenue, or for appropriating the same, shall originate in the House of Representatives, and shall not be so amended or altered by the Senate as to increase or diminish the sum to be raised, or change the mode of levying it, or the object of its appropriation."
In truth, Randolph's language basically reiterated, with a bit more precision, what the August 6th draft had proposed. However, it did allow for revisions and amendments by the Senate. It just couldn't change the overall amount or method of taxing or spending. He argued that because the larger states had conceded on equality in the Senate, the House, which of course would be based on population, should have this prerogative. George Mason supported the revision, explaining that the Senate would now have some voice in taxing and spending. Any concern that the Senate could not act on other issues that were addressed in a bill that happened to have taxing and spending in it was eliminated. He acknowledged that there had been some abuse of this privilege when state houses of representatives and the House of Commons had tacked on to revenue and spending bills unrelated measures to protect them from amendment by the second branch. This reform would eliminate that abuse. Mason continued.
These objections being removed, the arguments in favor of the proposed restraint on the Senate ought to have their full force. First, the Senate did not represent the people, but the states and their political character. It was improper, therefore, that it should tax the people.
Furthermore, Mason argued that the Senate having the power to amend money bills was not in any respect necessary in order to cure the evils of our Republican system. He understood that although the Republican form of government was the best, it had its own evils, especially that a political majority could oppress the minority, as well as the mischievous influence of demagogues. The Senate's ability to cause mischief needed to be checked by the authority of the House to originate money bills. The Senate just had too many other built-in advantages that could overcome the House that was not armed with an origination clause.
The Senate is not, like the House of Representatives, chosen frequently and obliged to return frequently among the people. They are to be chosen by the states for 6 years. We'll probably settle themselves at the seat of government, will pursue schemes for their own aggrandizement, will be able, by wearing out the House of Representatives, taking advantage of their impatience at the close of a long session, to extort measures for that purpose. If they should be paid out of the national treasury, they will particularly extort an increase of their wages.
Mason saw the germ of aristocracy, abuse, and corruption in the Senate that was not checked by an origination clause. He elaborated that contrary to James Wilson's and others' skepticism about the importance of originating money bills, as opposed to just amending, that maintaining origination with the House of Representatives was essential.
A bare negative was a very different thing from that of originating bills. The practice in England was in point. The House of Lords does not represent or tax the people because they are not elected by the people. If the Senate can originate, they will, in the recess of the legislative sessions, hatch their mischievous projects for their own purposes and have their money bills cut and dried, to use a common phrase, for the meeting of the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives might be rendered by degrees, like the Parliament of Paris, the mere depository of the decrees of the Senate. In all events, I contend that the purse strings should be in the hands of the representatives of the people.
Wilson was unconvinced. Remember, we told you he never lost the opportunity to re-debate issues. He argued this reservation of power to the House of Representatives would ensure intense antagonism between the chambers of the Congress. It would fester and cause grave disruptions between the branches. An insuperable objection against the proposed restriction of money bills to the House of Representatives is that it would be a source of perpetual contentions where there was no mediator to decide them. The president here could not, like the executive magistrate in England, interpose by a prorogation, that is, suspending Parliament from doing any business, or dissolution of the House and calling for new elections. This restriction had been found pregnant with altercation in every state where the Constitution had established it. The House of Representatives will insert other things in money bills, and by making them conditions of each other, destroy the deliberate liberty of the Senate. I state the case of a preamble to a money bill sent up by the House of Commons during the reign of Queen Anne to the House of Lords, in which the conduct of the misplaced ministry who were to be impeached before the Lords was condemned, the Commons, thus extorting a premature judgment without any hearing of the parties to be tried, and the House of Lords being thus reduced to the poor and disgraceful expedient of opposing to the authority of a law a protest on their journals against it being drawn into precedent. Wilson called upon both the American and English experience to show that this would be nothing but trouble. But he was an equal opportunity opposer. He would be against vesting in the Senate the sole authority to originate, because that too would not solve the problem. I should be equally opposed to an origination clause if the right were to be exclusively vested in the Senate. With regard to the purse strings, it was to be observed that the purse was to have two strings, one of which was in the hands of the House of Representatives, the other in those of the Senate. Both houses must concur in untying, and of what importance could it be which untied first and which last? I cannot conceive it to be any objection to the Senate's preparing the bills that they would have the leisure for that purpose and would be in the habits of business. War, commerce, and revenue were the great objects of the general government. All of them are connected with money. The restriction in favor of the House of Representatives would exclude the Senate from originating any important bills whatsoever. Elbridge Gerry was unimpressed. In fact, he reacted with a very strong cautionary note. If this House did not retain the sole power to originate money bills, the whole Constitutional Convention was likely to fail.
I consider this as a part of the plan that would be much scrutinized. Taxation and representation are strongly associated in the minds of the people, and they will not agree that any but their immediate representatives shall meddle with their purses. In short, the acceptance of the plan will inevitably fail if the Senate be not restrained from originating money bills.
Governor Morris responded that the Senate would tire out the other house and extort their concurrence in favorite measures as well by withholding their negative as by adhering to a bill introduced by themselves. Madison, who had been mostly silent, unwrapped a fine new present for the convention to consider. Really, it was just George Reed's early proposal to reserve to the House the sole authority to originate money bills, but allow the Senate the authority to amend them.
It would be proper to allow the Senate at least so to amend as to diminish the sums to be raised. Why should they be restrained from checking the extravagance of the other House? One of the greatest evils incident to Republican government was the spirit of contention and faction.
But in typical Madison fashion, he was not done. He opposed Randolph's amendment for other more technical, lawyerly reasons as well.
The word revenue was ambiguous. In many acts, particularly in the regulation of trade, the object would be twofold. The raising of revenue would be one of them. How could it be determined which was the primary or predominant one, or whether it was necessary that revenue should be the sole object in exclusion even of other incidental effects? When the contest was first opened with Great Britain, their power to regulate trade was admitted, their power to raise revenue rejected. An accurate investigation of the subject afterwards proved that no line could be drawn between the two cases. The words amend or alter form an equal source of doubt and altercation. When an obnoxious paragraph shall be sent down from the Senate to the House of Representatives, it will be called an origination under the name of an amendment. The Senate may actually couch extraneous matter under that name. In these cases, the question will turn on the degree of connection between the matter and object of the bill and the alteration or amendment offered to it. Can there be a more fruitful source of dispute, or a kind of dispute more difficult to be settled? My apprehensions on this point are not conjectural. Disputes had actually flowed from this source in Virginia, where the Senate can originate no bill. The words, so as to increase or diminish the sum to be raised, were liable to the same objections. In levying indirect taxes, which it seemed to be understood were to form the principal revenue of the new government, the sum to be raised would be increased or diminished by a variety of collateral circumstances influencing the consumption in general, the consumption of foreign or of domestic articles, of this or that particular species of articles, or even by the mode of collection, which may be closely connected with the productiveness of a tax.
Obviously, the precise lawyer in Madison also came out in this passage as he dissected the verbiage of the proposed amendment and how unclear it might be. But now rose another, more experienced lawyer, a lion during the lead-up to the Revolution, Pennsylvania's John Dickinson, who eschewed the technicalities that Madison was raising. Experience had proven the worth of reserving to the House originating money bills, and experience proved it should be adopted.
Experience must be our only guide. Reason may mislead us. It was not reason that discovered the singular and admirable mechanism of the English Constitution. It was not reason that discovered, or ever could have discovered, the odd and in the eyes of those who are governed by reason, the absurd mode of trial by jury. Accidents probably produced these discoveries, and experience has given a sanction to them. This is then our guide. And has not experience verified the utility of restraining money bills to the immediate representatives of the people? Whence the effect may have proceeded, inspired the other branches of government to the House of Commons, or from the turn of thinking it gave to the people at large with regard their rights. But the effect was visible and could not be doubted. Shall we oppose to this long experience the short experience of 11 years since 1776, which we had ourselves on this subject? As to disputes, they could not be avoided anyways. If both houses should originate, each would have a different bill to which it would be attached and for which it would contend.
That was not all. Like Gary, Dickinson was convinced that the people would absolutely reject the proposed Constitution if the House of Representatives was not vested with the sole authority to originate money bills.
All prejudices of the people would be offended by refusing this exclusive privilege to the House of Representatives, and these prejudices should never be disregarded by us when no essential purpose was to be served. When this plan goes forth, it will be attacked by the popular leaders. Aristocracy will be the watchword, the shibboleth amongst its adversaries. 8 states have inserted in their constitutions the exclusive right of originating money bills in favor of the popular branch of the legislature. Most of them, however, allowed the other branch to amend. This would be proper for us to do.
Delegates Randolph, Rutledge, Carroll, and McHenry all added their own comments, mostly which echoed those made by others. The convention progressed, and after several rounds of voting, postponements, and revisions, almost all of which all but regurgitated the same arguments over and over, on September 8th, the convention accepted the final constitutional language, 9 votes to 2. The part of the August 6th draft which required spending bills to also originate with the House was dropped, which means that under the origination clause, the House must originate revenue bills, but the Senate can amend. Period. The question then became, would this be a source of controversy during the ratification debates, or would it be readily embraced? And Judge Warren looks like he's about to burst. Would you like to take it from here?
Finally. Why, thank you, Mike Girard. How delightful they are finally giving me the microphone. Thank goodness I wrote the script or I'd be shut out completely. Wait a minute. I wrote the script. Never mind. In any event, to answer the question, the Federalist Papers skipped by this issue. Almost. James Madison, who we have learned became somewhat of a chameleon in connection with the Constitution, addressed the issue in Federalist Paper number 58. Now, we call him a chameleon because he fought like heck against many provisions that were adopted in the Constitutional Convention, and then he became the strongest proponent of the same provisions when writing in the Federalist Papers. With regard to the Origination Clause, he wrote in Federalist Paper number 58,
"The House of Representatives cannot only refuse, but they alone can propose the supplies requisite for the support of the government. This power over the purse may, in fact, be regarded as the most complete and effectual weapon with which any constitution can arm the immediate representatives of the people, for obtaining a redress of every grievance, and for carrying into effect every just and salutary measure."
So Madison's less than enthusiastic support of the language, remember how he vigorously opposed the use of the word revenue in the Constitution, flipped into calling it the greatest weapon the House of Representatives had to defend the people. I chalk this up to Madison not being spineless or a man with no principle, but as an ardent patriot who makes his best arguments, accepts reasonable compromises, and defends what is best for his country. Alexander Hamilton, Madison's major partner in the Federalist Papers enterprise, had to depart even further from his views from the convention. Hamilton was all but a monarchist, and his plan for the Constitution in the convention completely omitted anything approximating an origination clause. But in Federalist Paper number 68, he called upon it as showing how the powers of the House balanced out the authority given to the Senate, thereby allowing the people's representatives a major stake and voice in the federal government.
"To secure the equilibrium of the National House of Representatives, the plan of the convention has provided in its favor several important counterpoises to the additional authorities to be conferred upon the Senate. The exclusive privilege of originating money bills will belong to the House of Representatives. The same House will possess the sole right of instituting impeachments. Is not this a complete counterbalance to that of determining them? The same House will be an umpire in all elections of the President, which do not unite the suffrages of the majority of the whole number of electors. A case which it cannot be doubted will sometimes, if not frequently, happen."
This dynamic duel of Madison and Hamilton were not the only Federalists who relied on the Origination Clause as a strong reason to support the ratification of the Constitution. Pennsylvanian and soon-to-be member of the last Continental Congress, Tench Cox, defended the Constitutional Convention's decision. He thought this compromise gave the Senate a necessary voice in these matters, but still provided that the House of Representatives would have the ultimate say on how revenues were raised. "The Senate, though more independent of the people as to the free exercise of their judgment and abilities than the House of Representatives, by their longer term of their office, must be older and more experienced men and the public treasurers. The sinews of the state cannot be called forth by their original motion. They must restrain the profusion of errors of the House of Representatives, but they cannot take the necessary measures to raise a national revenue." On the other hand, Constitutional Convention delegate George Mason's objections to the Constitution were published in the Virginia Journal on November 22nd of 1787. He attacked the power of the Senate to alter money bills as one of the many reasons why the Senate would destroy any balance in the government, which would
"enable them to accomplish what usurpations they please upon the rights of the liberties of the people."
But, just like in the convention, Federalists rallied against Mason. In fact, one Virginian writer, who wrote under the pen name Civis Rusticus, Latin for simple citizen, noted that the Senate was not like the House of Lords. The Lords were permanent and hereditary. The Senate would be elected by the state legislatures, and senators would necessarily rotate in and out.
The Senate will have the power of altering money bills. And why not? Because the Lords in England, a hereditary aristocracy, have not, of late years, been permitted by the Commons to exercise this power? Shall the Senate, a rotatory body chosen by the representatives of the people, be deprived of this essential right of the legislation? The people cannot be taxed but by the consent of their immediate representatives.
Echoing similar sentiments, James Iredell of North Carolina also responded to Mason in a series of essays under the pseudonym Marcus. Iredell was a former state judge and attorney general and served in the North Carolina State Assembly. He also compiled and revised the state's laws. He would eventually serve on the United States Supreme Court. In his first essay, he wrote a thorough answer of why the right to amend by the Senate was proper and hardly dangerous.
The House of Representatives, as immediately representing the people, are to originate all money bills. This, I think, extremely right, and it is certainly a very capital acquisition to the popular representative. But what harm can arise from the Senate, who are nearly a popular representative also, to propose amendments when those amendments must be concurred by the original proposers? The wisdom of the Senate may sometimes point out amendments, the propriety of which the House may be very sensible of, though they had not occurred to themselves. There is no great danger of any body of men suffering by too eager an adoption of any amendment proposed to any system of their own. The probability is stronger of their being too tenacious of their original opinion, however erroneous, than of their printing by the wise information of any other persons whatever. Human nature is so constituted, and therefore I think we safely confide in the admission of a free intercourse of opinion on the details of business as well as to taxation as to other points. Our House of Representatives surely cannot have such reason to dread the power of a Senate circumstanced as ours must be, as the House of Commons in England, the permanent authority of the peers, and therefore a jealousy which may be well grounded in the one case would be entirely ill-directed in the other.
Interestingly, this topic was barely addressed in the state ratifying conventions, although Iredell made a similar argument at the North Carolina Convention. In the end, the origination clause that was so hotly contested at the Constitutional Convention basically slipped by without much of a debate. Based on the lack of controversy surrounding the final text, it appears that the Constitutional Convention wisely chose a middle ground that nearly all could agree to. In the ratifying conventions and the press, the origination clause was overshadowed by many other concerns. Nevertheless, it's an exceedingly important provision that should not be overlooked. If the House does not pass a bill to raise money, the federal government shuts down. Period. A very powerful clause indeed. Some key takeaways from this episode. Any bill raising revenue must originate in the House of Representatives. This ensures that taxation and similar means of raising money must first be proposed by the House of Representatives, which is composed of the most immediate representatives of the people. It preserves the keystone of no taxation without representation. The Senate has the authority to amend or concur in amendments, just like any other bill. This ensures that the wisdom and experience of the Senate can weigh in on these important matters without allowing them to cower or coerce the House and prevents an aristocracy from taking hold. I am Oakland County, Michigan Circuit Court Judge Michael Warren and author of America's Survival Guide, How to Stop America's Impending Suicide by Reclaiming Our First Principles in History. Our other two fabulous Patriot narrators are Mike Gerard Skenechny, who is our sound designer and Patriot Week's video content producer, and the fabulous amateur historian, bombastic Brent Bassett. This podcast is produced by Patriot Week. Please visit Patriot Week's website at patriotweek.org to learn more about America's first principles, key documents and speeches, founding fathers and other great patriots, and flags from our history, along with the fantastic resources we have to offer. Our fellow patriots, thank you for listening. Until next time, when we continue our exploration of the United States Congress, God bless you and God bless America.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Thank you, our fellow patriots, for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast and rate us. That is, if you're going to give us those 5 golden stars. We can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and many other platforms. You can also find much more at patriotweek.org, which includes videos, lesson plans, TV episodes, and many other goodies. Patriot Week is celebrated every year from September 11th, the anniversary of the terrorist attacks, through September 17th, the anniversary of the signing of the Constitution. It has been recognized by the U.S. Senate and many states. Patriot Week was started by then 10-year-old Leah Warren when she pounded on the table and demanded a new celebration of America. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and on Instagram, or reach out directly at mwarren@patriotweek.org. Also consider Judge Warren's book, America's Survival Guide, How to Stop America's Impending Suicide by Reclaiming Our First Principles and History, by visiting americasurvivalguide.com, Amazon, or any other online retailer. Until next time, God bless you and God bless America.